We're here at the Edinburgh Fringe on day one, and we're talking improvisation, and we might be talking improv. And my opening question to John Creamer, who I haven't spoken to for years in terms of an interview in a theatre context, John. Somebody was there in the early days of a very well-known improv group, a well-respected group up here, which are the Maydays. I'm going to be honest, and this is not an attack, but I don't like improv at the Fringe, and I tend not to see it. I would like you to tell me what's wrong with me.
It's a taste thing, isn't it? Some people don't like different things, and if you don't like improv, I'm sure there's a reason for that, which we could explore. Do you have a sense of why you don't like improv at the Fringe, or is this improv generally?
Oh, good. So I'm going to get some free coaching here, but Hopefully a good interview is going to emerge as well that's going to get into the heart of this. For me, we've talked about this before, I absolutely love, and I've written about, improvisation. And I've experienced, particularly at the Fringe, improv as being definitely sometimes an exhilarating, amazing form of improvisation, but often that seems to keep falling back on structure and cheating.
What do you mean by structure and cheating, Paul?
Yeah, it's that, you know, we're going to do the I've got that mad blah blah blues, but we've already decided the song and we're just going to change a few words. Or we're going to do a drama where we find out who the murderer is and we're going to get suggestions from the audience, but we've already got a vessel in which that goes and a pretty defined structure. So we do improvise some of the story, but we keep having to fall back on the opposite of improv, which is scriptedness.
It's a balancing act, isn't it?
Why is it a balancing act? Why can't it be pure?
It can be pure. When it's pure, it tends to be higher risk, and it can go horribly wrong and be much more of a mess. I personally enjoy that. Give me that any day of the week. I have a colleague named Michael Alosso, very successful professional speaker, and his mantra is structure frees creativity. So a completely structureless experience generally is a mess. An overly structured experience is dull. You can watch it three nights in a row, and as you say, people are just inserting, you know, character here or this mad thing here, or oh well, we found out who the murderer is, etc.
Right, so I buy that, and you know, I've seen long form improv that's failed and some that succeeded, but the edginess of it as theatre is that it could fail or succeed, and that's part of the reason for going. But up here at the Edinburgh Fringe that I love, there's probably about 50 improv shows that have put that keyword in, and I'd say 45 of them are now wearing branded t-shirts, baseball hats, to come back year after year, and it's become more and more structured, not less.
This is my first Edinburgh Festival, and my limited understanding of Edinburgh is that audiences go back to see things that they enjoyed the year before. So there needs to be a consistency of a company that wants to return to Edinburgh to build audience, and that consistency has to be, you know, for want of a better word, some form of branding.
Yeah.
If your branding's through television, like Whose Line Is It Anyway, it's pretty safe. If your branding is self-generated, it's a bit more work.
Hmm.
And, yeah, personally, I enjoyed the less structured, more edgy stuff, and I get quite bored when I can sort of predict what's coming in a show.
Hmm. So for people that don't know, that might want to try out improv for the first time, maybe come and see their first Mayday show rather than returning fans. You've written a lot about improv. You've written books about it, about flow and so on. Let's just take a few of the terms, and if you could make them accessible to people, and they might also relight or light up my fire to go and see it.
Sure.
So what's yes and all about?
The idea of yes and, in my comprehension, is that you accept what is given to you by the other person, by the audience, by the moment, and you build on it. You accept it unconditionally, and you acknowledge that that is the reality in which you are engaged. It doesn't mean you have to love everything you're given. So a yes and may be something as simple as, whoopee, you've brought me a poodle, I love poodles. Or it may be, you've brought me a poodle, you know I'm allergic to dogs, you pig. So it's still acknowledging the reality and working with that reality.
So what we're seeing as audience is there are performers that when they're improvising, what they offer to somebody also on stage isn't blocked. You run with it.
You run with it. And this is a moment by moment. I mean, I see in many ways, good improvisation for me is like a martial art where you have that flexibility and agility to run with whatever you're given at any point. And when improv is compelling and thrilling is when those switches, those changes are happening moment to moment. And the improviser themselves is discovering what is happening rather than simply pulling on some technique or tricks.
So in terms of techniques and tricks, when we see, you know, the music start and they've already decided what the tune's going to be, but what they're going to vary is the lyrics and what they've been given, say, by the audience, do you think it is possible, say, in this context, to improvise the whole damn song, music and all?
I'm fortunate to work with some fiercely talented musical improvisers who are well beyond my skill and ability, and yes, they improvise, completely improvise songs that are structured, compelling, have verse and chorus, and I know for a fact are totally made up on the spot. We have been guilty in the past of having a song structure prepared that we slot lyrics into, usually to help people like myself for whom song is not a strength.
Right. And again, so for that audience that doesn't know, we're not talking about rehearsing a script, but this is a group that constantly practices their craft and warms up before they go on stage.
We practice and we learn from people that we admire. So we're always on the lookout for someone who can teach us something that will add to what it is we do. And the ultimate sign of an improv troupe is trust and rapport. And because we've been together for so long and we know each other's boundaries physically, mentally and emotionally, we have a level of trust where we can throw some pretty serious curveballs at each other, and that will delight us rather than intimidate us.
Right, so I'm saying it sounds like there's nothing wrong with me for not wanting to see improv that looks like it's cheating too much.
No, Paul, there's nothing wrong with you for not wanting to see. Well, you're an intelligent. I would call you a savvy consumer. So no one's going to be able to get any basic tricks past you. So yes, you will pretty quickly be able to spot the structure and the tricks. And there's nothing wrong with you for saying I don't personally like sitting down and watching that.
Yeah. As somebody that, I mean, you also go all over the world. You work with organisations, individuals, and so on. You know, in a much broader context than just improv. Why have you put yourself through coming back here to this madhouse?
This is my first time in Edinburgh.
Really? So you've never performed here before, but you haven't performed with Maydays for a while, have you?
I performed with the Maydays a couple of weeks ago. We did a show. I was away for a while in Chicago. And
rumours that you've retired are not true.
No, I haven't retired. I basically largely came here to be contrary because the Maydays have been coming here for about 12 years. And I always just said, no, I don't want to go. So when they stopped asking me, that's when I said, yes, I'll go.
The writer Jaron Lanier wrote a very famous book years back called You Are Not a Gadget, and it was about the digital world, about how we're all becoming gadgetized in our behavior. We think we've got free choice, but it's either, you know, do you press submit or not? Are you in or are you out? But it's a very structured world where we're largely controlled. What does improvisation, much more broadly, offer people who feel a bit stuck in their lives?
Okay, so that has touched a personal nerve for me. There was some news a couple of weeks ago about six-year-old children failing tests at school. They were asked to put commas into sentences, and they failed. About 50% of them failed because they put the commas in the right place in the sentences, but the commas were the wrong shape. We live in a world that, from my perspective, reduces young human beings to filing cabinets. And at some level, our spontaneous, creative humanity, our magic, as I refer to it as shorthand, gets buried. And improvisation can be a very adept shortcut at accessing someone's inner magic and giving it permission to come out. And for me, the key word in improvisation, and I've boiled this down over the last few years, is the word permission. Permission to simply be yourself. And for many people, many, the vast majority of people do not have that in any arena of their life, work, family, etc., etc. They do not have permission to be themselves.
And I guess Pink Floyd kind of called it becoming comfortably numb.
Comfortably numb, building a wall. Freud called it, you know, being cowed by the superego. The Sufis call it the cultural trance. The agreement that we have to make to not step out of line in order to survive as human beings. From a very early age, the choice is conform or die.
So a lot of people who might find themselves in an improv workshop that might not even want to go on the stage are getting some sort of personal benefit from just practicing improv?
Absolutely. The offstage benefits of improv are, to me, for some people, they're transformational. I've engaged with a lot of people who have changed their personal lives and their professional lives as the result of even just a few improv experiences that that enable them to see the world and themselves differently. It changes their relationship to themselves.
Someone from that world that told me they'd been to an improv workshop, and I'm not going to name drop, but basically came out saying, yeah, it was all right, but it was a bit kind of too friendly and happy-clappy.
Well, it's important to build trust and rapport. We live in a world where we're continually avoiding shame and exclusion. So one of the givens in an improv workshop is a sense of safety, emotional safety, that you're not going to be shamed or excluded by making a mistake or not doing things perfectly.
Yeah.
So yeah, for the more cynical amongst us, they would see that as being too happy-clappy and, you know, insincerely friendly. Mm. I've heard the phrase too American for some people.
Right.
Yeah. These are people that I doubt are having exciting lives.
As we've spoken, Donald Trump has just followed you on Twitter. In terms of, I don't want to overplay it, but in terms of me going to see a show tonight, it does sound like when improv's really good, it's a bit therapeutic being in an audience.
Yeah, I hate to come across as too new agey, but I think it can be. For myself, to watch a really accomplished improv performer can be shamanistic, can be cathartic. To see someone expressing and embodying elements of the human experience that you don't normally see embodied and expressed, and to know that that's unfolding spontaneously and has an authenticity to it, in that even though they're acting, they are fully embodying and experiencing what it is they're expressing. For me, that's a profound experience, which you don't get many places in this world.
Why do you need to collaborate with an audience in terms of them giving suggestions at various stages?
For me, it's a sense of inclusiveness. I keep coming back to culture. We live in a culture that separates ordinary people, you know, the masses, the consumer, from the talented people, the creative people, the artists, the singers, the actors.
Who are the elite?
The elite, of course. So we essentially pay money to the elite so that they will entertain us. So they'll sing us songs, tell us jokes, and we disempower ourselves in doing that. So to include the audience, and personally, I love to get true stories from the audience. That, to me, is the sweet spot. I have a background in playback theatre, which I found very useful in terms of honouring someone's story, playing out an element of that story on stage, and the room, everyone in that room is sharing an experience that is fundamental to when we sat round the fire hundreds of thousands of years ago and told stories and danced and reenacted the hunt or our lives.
And as May Days has kind of matured over quite a few years, has it moved in that direction too?
We've morphed and changed into many different directions over the years, and there is definitely an element of wanting to honour the audience, of wanting to respect the fact that it takes a bit of gumption to give a suggestion that's real. So one of our shows, for example, is based on confessions. To actually confess something that really happened takes courage, and if we can honour that and the audience can share in that experience, then we're creating something. Creating, to me, is the wrong word. It's we're participating in something that is spellbinding.
Do you think the audience collude in laughter?
What do you mean by colludes?
Well, once they're in, you know, it will be a desperate act of betrayal not to laugh at it all.
I hope not. We did a show yesterday and there wasn't much laughter, and we left there feeling a little bit sort of flat, and we sat down and reflected on the show and actually tried to put ourselves in the place of the audience. And what we came to was, we hadn't flagged up at the beginning of the show, it's okay to laugh at this. So they kind of got caught up in the drama. And when they laughed, there was almost a guilty sort of, ooh, should we be laughing moment, which I found really intriguing. It can be tempting to play for laughs. I catch myself doing it constantly. And for me, the best laughs come when there's been some drama, some depth. There's been a quiet spell. And then something breaks the tension. And the laughter is, to me, genuine and not collusive.
A bit of confession here. I've seen May Days over the years. I don't think when I've reviewed it, I've ever given it less than a highly recommended, which is a good rating on Fringe Review. But a couple of cynical Paul Levy-type comments up here. One of them, which I put to a devised theatre company, is one definition of devised theatre is when no one trusts one person to write it. And so you've got to have a good reason to devise things, kind of not. And sometimes when I've not laughed at improv, but seen everyone else kind of colluding to giggle, I've been annoyed because what the company on stage have done is they've accidentally fallen into some decent theatre.
I'm with you on this one. Some of my favourite improvisers, if you watch them for an hour, the laughs per hour count is pretty low, but the quality of drama, genuine drama, is high. Yeah. And that's, I agree with you, yeah. To diffuse something through nervous giggles rather than actually tasting the drama of it can be a bit of a missed opportunity for the audience.
Yeah, and, you know, I saw that in Katie and Rach, a double act in Brighton. Katie shooters up here, and they did have comedy, but sometimes it was just like serious drama for an hour, and you couldn't have written it better if you'd scripted it. So that flow state is necessary. In terms of the show that you guys are up with now then, what are May Days bringing to the Fringe this year?
Well, ironically, in light of the beginning of this interview when you talked about heavily branded improv companies with their outfits and their uniforms, we're bringing Happily Never After, which was largely the brainchild of our musician, Joe Samuel. And it's a sort of gothic-y flavoured fairy tale along the lines of Tim Burton or the Brothers Grimm. So it's got an undercurrent of darkness. It's got whimsy, and
it's got a lot of makeup. If you believe the flyer,
you don't often see me with eyeliner and a striped shirt. Let's just say that. And yeah, we do wear a lot of makeup. And again, part of the reason I came here was because I love this show. The structure and the flavour of it is compelling. It lends itself to drama, so that when the comedy occurs, it's accidental and incidental. And the other thing I love is the thing we asked for at the beginning of the show is the profession of the grandparent of one of the audience members. So we're already making a connection in terms of what did one of your grandparents do for a living? So this is real nuts and bolts stuff, and at least one person in that audience is going to be highly engaged because it's a part of their family story.
And for people that don't know, again, what's going on in the 10 minutes before you're all on stage?
In the 10 minutes before we're on stage, we have a couple of ritual warm-ups that we do. We're generally very rude to each other. We invade each other's personal space. We laugh. We get nervous. We warm up physically. And then one of our rituals, which we got from Chicago, was we make eye contact with each other. Literally tap each other on the back and say, "Got your back." So it's the idea that you're not walking on that stage alone, that someone is there just waiting to come in and support you.
John Creamer, improv guru, Edinburgh Fringe rookie, thanks for talking to us.